Death was proverbial with him, the thief in the night about which all his goodness or courage could do nothing. But this is not the principal thing which I came to tell you. It is this. You can rule the plantation, and you can save it. All that is required is that you let no one convince you otherwise. You must assume his position despite any outcry, any talk of convention, any talk of propriety or common sense. You must listen to nothing. The same land is here now that was here yesterday morning when your brother slept above. Nothing is changed. You must take his place. If you do not, the land is lost and the family is lost. You will be five women on a small pension doomed to live but half or less of what life could give you. Learn what you must know. Stop at nothing until you have the answers, and take my visitation to you to be your courage whenever you waver. You must take the reins of your own life. Your brother is dead. I could see by her face that she had heard every word. She would have questioned me had there been time, but she believed me when I said there was not. Then I used all my skill to leave her so swiftly I appeared to vanish. From the garden I saw her face above in the glow of her candles. I saw her search the dark for me, turning around and around, and then I saw her make the sign of the cross and walk back to her sisters within. The vampire smiled. There was absolutely no talk on the river coast of any strange apparition to Babette Frenière. But after the first mourning and sad talk of the women left all alone, she became the scandal of the neighborhood, because she chose to run the plantation on her own. She managed an immense dowry for her younger sister, and was married herself in another year. And Lestat and I almost never exchanged words.
Did he go on living at Pointe du Lac?
Yes. I could not be certain he'd told me all I needed to know, and great pretense was necessary. My sister was married in my absence, for example, while I had a malarial chill, and something similar overcame me the morning of my mother's funeral. Meantime, Lestat and I sat down to dinner each night with the old man and made nice noises with our knives and forks, while he told us to eat everything on our plates and not to drink our wine too fast. With dozens of miserable headaches I would receive my sister in a darkened bedroom, the covers up to my chin, bid her and her husband bear with the dim light on account of the pain in my eyes, as I entrusted to them large amounts of money to invest for us all. Fortunately, her husband was an idiot. A harmless one, but an idiot. The product of four generations of marriages between first cousins. But though these things went well, we began to have our problems with the slaves. They were the suspicious ones, and, as I've indicated, Lestat killed anyone and everyone he chose. So there was always some talk of mysterious death on that part of the coast. But it was what they saw of us which began the talk, and I heard it one evening when I was playing a shadow about the slave cabins. Now, let me explain first the character of these slaves. It was only about 1795, Lestat and I having lived there for 4 years in relative quiet, I investing the money which he acquired, increasing our lands, purchasing apartments and townhouses in New Orleans which I rented, the work of the plantation itself producing little, more a cover for us than an investment. I say our. This is wrong. I never signed anything over to Lestat, and as you realize, I was still legally alive. But in 1795 these slaves did not have the character which you've seen in films and novels of the South. They were not soft-spoken, brown-skinned people in drab rags who spoke an English dialect. They were Africans, and they were islanders. That is, some of them had come from Santo Domingo. They were very black and totally foreign. They spoke in their African tongues, and they spoke the French patois, and when they sang African songs which made the fields exotic and strange, always frightening to me in my mortal life. They were superstitious, and had their own secrets and traditions. In short, they had not yet been destroyed as Africans completely. Slavery was the curse of their existence, but they had not been robbed yet of that which had been characteristically theirs. They tolerated the baptism and modest garments imposed on them by the French Catholic laws, but in the evenings they made their cheap fabrics into alluring costumes, made jewelry of animal bones and bits of discarded metal which they polished to look like gold. And the slave cabins of Pointe du Lac were a foreign country, an African coast after dark, in which not even the coldest overseer would want to wander. No fear for the vampire. Not until one summer evening, when, passing for a shadow, I heard through the open doors of the black foreman's cottage a conversation which convinced me that Lestat and I slept in real danger. The slaves knew now we were not ordinary mortals. In hushed tones, the maids told of how, through a crack in the door, they had seen us dine on empty plates with empty silver, lifting empty glasses to our lips, laughing, our faces bleached and ghostly in the candlelight, the blind man a helpless fool in our power. Through keyholes they had seen Lestat's coffin, and once he had beaten one of them mercilessly for dawdling by the gallery windows of his room. "There is no bed in there," they confided one to the other with nodding heads. "He sleeps in the coffin, I know it." They were convinced, on the best of grounds, of what we were. And as for me, they'd seen me evening after evening emerge from the oratory, which was now little more than a shapeless mass of brick and vine, layered with flowering wisteria in the spring, wild roses in summer, moss gleaming on the old unpainted shutters which had never been opened, spiders spinning in the stone arches. Of course, I'd pretended to visit it in memory of Paul, but it was clear by their speech they no longer believed such lies. And now they attributed to us not only the deaths of slaves found in the fields and swamps, and also the dead cattle and occasional horses, but all other strange events, even floods and thunder, the weapons of God in a personal battle waged with Louis and Lestat. But worse still, they were not planning to run away. We were devils, our power inescapable. No, we must be destroyed. And at this gathering where I became an unseen member were a number of the Frenier slaves. This meant word would get to the entire coast, and though I firmly believed the entire coast to be impervious to a wave of hysteria, I did not intend to risk notice of any kind. I hurried back to the plantation house to tell Lestat our game of playing planter was over. He'd have to give up his slave whip and golden napkin ring and move into town. He resisted, naturally. His father was gravely ill and might not live. He had no intention of running away from stupid slaves. "I'll kill them all," he said calmly, "in threes and fours. Some will run away and that will be fine." "You're talking madness. The fact is I want you gone from here."
"You want me gone?"
"You," he sneered. He was building a card palace on the dining room table with a pack of very fine French cards. "You whining coward of a vampire who prowls the night killing alley cats and rats and staring for hours at candles as if they were people and standing in the rain like a zombie until your clothes are drenched and you smell like old wardrobe trunks in attics and have the look of a baffled idiot at the zoo. You have nothing more to tell me, and your insistence on recklessness has endangered us both. I might live in that oratory alone while this house fell to ruin. I don't care about it," I told him, because this was quite true. "But you must have all the things you never had of life, and make of immortality a junk shop in which both of us become grotesque. Now, go look at your father and tell me how long he has to live, for that's how long you stay, and only if the slaves don't rise up against us." He told me then to go look at his father myself, since I was the one who was always looking, and I did. The old man was truly dying. I had been spared my mother's death, more or less, because she had died very suddenly on an afternoon.
She'd been found with her sewing basket, seated quietly in the courtyard. She had died as one goes to sleep. But now I was seeing a natural death that was too slow, with agony and with consciousness. And I'd always liked the old man. He was kindly and simple and made few demands. By day he sat in the sun of the gallery, dozing and listening to the birds. By night any chatter on our part kept him company. He could play chess, carefully feeling each piece and remembering the entire state of the board with remarkable accuracy. And though Lestat would never play with him, I did often. Now he lay gasping for breath, his forehead hot and wet, the pillows around him stained with sweat. And as he moaned and prayed for death, Lestat in the other room began to play the spinet. I slammed it shut, barely missing his fingers. "You won't play while he dies," I said. "The hell I won't," he answered me. "I'll play the drum if I like." And taking a great sterling silver platter from a sideboard, he slipped a finger through one of its handles and beat it with a spoon. I told him to stop it, or I would make him stop it. And then we both ceased our noise, because the old man was calling his name. He was saying that he must talk to Lestat now, before he died. I told Lestat to go to him. The sound of his crying was terrible. "Why should I? I've cared for him all these years, isn't that enough?"
And he drew from his pocket a nail file, and, seating himself on the foot of the old man's bed, he began to file his long nails.
Meantime, I should tell you that I was aware of slaves about the house. They were watching and listening. I was, truly, hoping the old man would die within minutes. Once or twice before I dealt with suspicion or doubt on the part of several slaves, but never such a number. I immediately rang for Daniel, the slave to whom I'd given the overseer's house and position, but while I waited for him, I could hear the old man talking to Lestat. Lestat, who sat with his legs crossed, filing and filing, one eyebrow arched, his attention on his perfect nails. "It was the school," the old man was saying. "Oh, I know you remember. What can I say to you?" he moaned. "You'd better say it," Lestat said, "because you're about to die." The old man let out a terrible noise, and I suspect I made some sound of my own. I positively loathed Lestat. I had a mind now to get him out of the room. "Well, you know that, don't you? Even a fool like you knows that," said Lestat. "You'll never forgive me, will you? Not now, not even after I'm dead," said the old man. "I don't know what you're talking about," said Lestat. My patience was becoming exhausted with him, and the old man was becoming more and more agitated. He was begging Lestat to listen to him with a warm heart. The whole thing was making me shudder. Meantime, Daniel had come, and I knew the moment I saw him that everything at Pointe du Lac was lost. Had I been more attentive, I'd have seen signs of it before now. He looked at me with eyes of glass. I was a monster to him. "Monsieur Lestat's father is very ill." "Going," I said, ignoring his expression. "I want no noise tonight. The slaves must all stay within the cabins. A doctor is on his way." He stared at me as if I were lying. And then his eyes moved curiously and coldly away from me towards the old man's door. His face underwent such a change that I rose at once and looked in the room. It was Lestat, slouched at the foot of the bed, his back to the bedpost, his nail file working furiously, grimacing in such a way that both his great teeth showed prominently. The vampire stopped, his shoulders shaking with silent laughter. He was looking at the boy, and the boy looked shyly at the table, but he had already looked and fixedly at the vampire's mouth. He had seen that the lips were of a different texture from the vampire's skin, that they were silken and delicately lined like any person's lips, only deadly white, and he had glimpsed the white teeth. Only the vampire had such a way of smiling that they were not completely revealed. and the boy had not even thought of such teeth until now.
"You can imagine," said the vampire, "what this meant. I had to kill him."
"You what?"
said the boy.
"I had to kill him. He started to run. He would have alarmed everyone. Perhaps it might have been handled some other way, but I had no time. So I went after him, overpowering him. But then, finding myself in the act of doing what I had not done for 4 years, I stopped. This was a man. He had his bone-handled knife in his hand to defend himself, and I took it from him easily and slipped it into his heart. He sank to his knees at once, his fingers tightening on the blade, bleeding on it, and the sight of the blood, the aroma of it, maddened me. I believe I moaned aloud, but I did not reach for him. I would not. Then I remember seeing Lestat's figure emerge in the mirror over the sideboard. "Why did you do this?" he demanded. I turned to face him, determined he would not see me in this weakened state. "The old man was delirious," he went on. "He could not understand what the old man was saying. The slaves, they know. You must go to the cabins and keep watch," I managed to say to him. "I'll care for the old man."
"Kill him," Lestat said.
"Are you mad?" I answered.
"He is your father." "I know he is my father," said Lestat. "That's why you have to kill him. I can't kill him. If I could, I would have done it a long time ago, damn him." He wrung his hands. "We've got to get out of here. And look what you've done, killing this one. There's no time to lose. His wife will be wailing up here in minutes, or she'll send someone worse."
The vampire sighed.
This was all true. Lestat was right. I could hear the slaves gathering around Daniel's cottage, waiting for him. Daniel had been brave enough to come into the haunted house alone. When he didn't return, the slaves would panic, become a mob. I told Lestat to calm them, to use all his power as a white master over them, and not to alarm them with horror, and then I went into the bedroom and shut the door. I had then another shock, in a night of shocks, because I'd never seen Lestat's father as he was then. He was sitting up now, leaning forward, talking to Lestat, begging Lestat to answer him, telling him he understood his bitterness better than Lestat did himself. And he was a living corpse. Nothing animated his sunken body but a fierce will. Hence his eyes, for their gleam, were all the more sunken in his skull, and his lips in their trembling made his old yellowed mouth more horrible. I sat at the foot of the bed, and, suffering to see him so, I gave him my hand. I cannot tell you how much his appearance had shaken me, for when I bring death, it is swift and conscienceless, leaving the victim as if in enchanted sleep. But this was the slow decay, the body refusing to surrender to the vampire of time, which had sucked upon it for years on end. "Lestat," he said, "just for once don't be hard with me. Just for once be for me the boy you were. My son." He said this, over and over, the words, "My son, my son." And then he said something I could not hear about innocence, and innocence destroyed. But I could see that he was not out of his mind, as Lestat thought, but in some terrible state of lucidity. The burden of the past was on him with full force, and the present, which was only death, which he fought with all his will, could do nothing to soften that burden. But I knew I might deceive him if I used all my skill, and, bending close to him now, I whispered the word, "Father." It was not Lestat's voice, it was mine, a soft whisper. But he calmed at once, and I thought then he might die. But he held my hand as if he were being pulled under by dark ocean waves, and I alone could save him.
He talked now of some country teacher, a name garbled, who found in Lestat a brilliant pupil and begged to take him to a monastery for an education. He cursed himself for bringing Lestat home, for burning his books. "You must forgive me, Lestat," he cried. I pressed his hand tightly, hoping this might do for some answer, but he repeated this again. "You have it all to live for, but you are as cold and brutal as I was then, with the work always there, and the cold and hunger. Lestat, you must remember, you were the gentlest of them all. God will forgive me if you forgive me." Well, at that moment the real Esau came through the door. I gestured for quiet, but he wouldn't see that. So I had to get up quickly so the father wouldn't hear his voice from a distance. The slaves had run from him. "But they're out there. They're gathered in the dark. I hear them," said Lestat, and then he glared at the old man. "Kill him, Louis," he said to me, his voice touched with the first pleading I'd ever heard in it. Then he bit down in rage. "Do it! Lean over that pillow and tell him you forgive him all. Forgive him for taking you out of school when you were a boy. Tell him that now." "For what?" Lestat grimaced, so that his face looked like a skull. "Taking me out of school?" He threw up his hands and let out a terrible roar of desperation. "Damn him! Kill him!" he said. "No," I said. "You forgive him, or you kill him yourself. Go on. Kill your own father." The old man begged to be told what we were saying. He called out, "Son, son," and Lestat danced like the maddened Rumpelstiltskin about to put his foot through the floor. I went to the lace curtains. I could see and hear the slaves surrounding the house of Pointe du Lac, forms woven in the shadows drawing near. "You were Joseph among your brothers," the old man said, "the best of them, but how was I to know? It was when you were gone I knew, when all those years passed and they could offer me no comfort, no solace. And then you came back to me and took me from the farm, but it wasn't you. It wasn't the same boy." I turned on Lestat now and veritably dragged him towards the bed. Never had I seen him so weak and at the same time enraged. He shook me off and then knelt down near the pillow, glowering at me. I stood resolute and whispered, "Forgive." "It's all right, father. You must rest easy. I hold nothing against you," he said, his voice thin and strained over his anger. The old man turned on the pillow, murmuring something soft with relief, but Lestat was already gone. He stopped short in the doorway, his hands over his ears. "They're coming," he whispered, and then turning just so he could see me, he said, "Take him, for God's sake!" The old man never even knew what happened. He never awoke from his stupor. I bled him just enough, opening the gash so he would then die without feeding my dark passion. That thought I couldn't bear. I knew now it wouldn't matter if the body was found in this manner, because I had had enough of Pointe du Lac and Lestat, and all this identity of Pointe du Lac's prosperous master. I would torch the house and turn to the wealth I'd held under many names, safe for just such a moment. Meantime, Lestat was after the slaves. He would leave such ruin and death behind him. No one could make a story of that night at Pointe du Lac, and I went with him. As before, his ferocity was mysterious, but now I bared my fangs on the humans who fled from me, my steady advance overcoming their clumsy, pathetic speed as the veil of death descended, or the veil of madness. The power and the proof of the vampire was incontestable, so that the slaves scattered in all directions, and it was I who ran back up the steps to put the torch to Pointe du Lac. Lestat came bounding after me. "What are you doing?" he shouted. "Are you mad?" But there was no way to put out the flames. "They're gone, and you're destroying it, all of it." He turned round and round in the magnificent parlour amid his fragile splendour. "Get your coffin out. You have 3 hours till dawn," I said. The house was a funeral pyre.
"'Could the fire have hurt you?' asked the boy.
"'Most definitely,' said the vampire.
"'Did you go back to the oratory? Was it safe?'
"'No, not at all. Some 55 slaves were scattered around the grounds. Many of them would not have desired the life of a runaway, and would most certainly go right to Frenière, or south to the Bergerdin plantation downriver. I had no intention of staying there that night, but there was little time to go anywhere else.
"'The woman, Babette,' said the boy. The vampire smiled.
"'Yes, I went to Babette. She lived now at Frenière with her young husband. I had enough time to load my coffin into the carriage and go to her.
But what about Lestat?'
The vampire sighed. Lestat went with me. It was his intention to go on to New Orleans, and he was trying to persuade me to do just that. But when he saw I meant to hide at Frenière, he opted for that also. We might not have ever made it to New Orleans. It was growing light. Not so that mortal eyes would have seen it, but Lestat and I could see it. Now, as for Babette, I had visited her once again. As I told you, she had scandalized the coast by remaining alone on the plantation without a man in the house, without even an older woman. Babette's greatest problem was that she might succeed financially, only to suffer the isolation of social ostracism. She had such a sensibility that wealth itself meant nothing to her. Family. A line. This meant something to Babette. Though she was able to hold the plantation together, the scandal was wearing on her. She was giving up inside. I came to her one night in the garden. Not permitting her to look on me, I told her in a most gentle voice that I was the same person she'd seen before, that I knew of her life and her suffering. "Don't expect people to understand it," I told her. "They are fools. They want you to retire because of your brother's death. They would use your life as if it were merely oil for a proper lamp. You must defy them, but you must defy them with purity and confidence." She was listening all the while in silence. I told her she was to give a ball for a cause, and the cause to be religious. She might pick a convent in New Orleans, any one, and plan for a philanthropic ball. She would invite her deceased mother's dearest friends to be chaperones, and she would do all of this with perfect confidence. Above all, perfect confidence. It was confidence and purity which were all important. Well, Babette thought this to be a stroke of genius. "I don't know what you are, and you will not tell me," she said. This was true, I would not. "But I can only think that you are an angel." And she begged to see my face. That is, she begged in the manner of such people as Babette, who are not given to truly begging anyone for anything. Not that Babette was proud. She was simply strong and honest, which in most cases makes begging— "I see you want to ask me a question." The vampire stopped. "Oh, no," said the boy, who had meant to hide it. "But you mustn't be afraid to ask me anything. If I held something too close—"
And when the vampire said this, his face darkened for an instant. He frowned, and as his brows drew together, a small well appeared in the flesh of his forehead over his left brow, as though someone had pressed it with a finger. It gave him a peculiar look of deep distress.
"If I held something too close for you to ask about it, I would not bring it up in the first place," he said.
The boy found himself staring at the vampire's eyes, at the eyelashes which were fine black wires in the tender flesh of the lids.
"Ask me," he said to the boy.
"Babette, the way you speak of her," said the boy, "as if your feeling was special."
"Did I give you the impression I could not feel?" asked the vampire.
"No, not at all. Obviously you felt for the old man. You stayed to comfort him when you were in danger. And what you felt for young Frenier when Lestat wanted to kill him, all this you explained. But I was wondering, did you have a special feeling for Babette? Was it feeling for Babette all along that caused you to protect Frenier?
You mean love, said the vampire. Why do you hesitate to say it?
Because you spoke of detachment, said the boy.
Do you think that angels are detached? Asked the vampire.
The boy thought for a moment.
Yes, he said. But aren't angels capable of love? Asked the vampire. Don't angels gaze upon the face of God with complete love?
The boy thought for a moment.
Love or adoration? He said. What is the difference? Asked the vampire thoughtfully. What is the difference?
It was clearly not a riddle for the boy. He was asking himself.
Angels feel love and pride, the pride of the fall, and hatred. The strong, overpowering emotions of detached persons in whom emotion and will are one, he said finally.
He stared at the table now, as though he were thinking this over, was not entirely satisfied with it.
I had for Babette a strong feeling. It is not the strongest I have ever known for a human being.
He looked up at the boy.
But it was very strong. Babette was to me in her own way an ideal human being.
He shifted in his chair, the cape moving softly about him, and turned his face to the windows. The boy bent forward and checked the tape. Then he took another cassette from his briefcase and, begging the vampire's pardon, fitted it into place.
I'm afraid I did ask something too personal. I didn't mean, he said anxiously to the vampire. You asked nothing of the sort, said the vampire, looking at him suddenly. It is a question, right to the point. I feel love. And I felt some measure of love for Babette, though not the greatest love I've ever felt. It was foreshadowed in Babette. To return to my story, Babette's charity ball was a success and her re-entry in social life assured by it. Her money generously underwrote any doubts in the minds of her suitors' families, and she married. On summer nights I used to visit her, never letting her see me or know that I was there. I came to see that she was happy. On seeing her happy, I felt a happiness as the result. And to Babette I came now with Lestat. He would have killed the Freniers long ago if I hadn't stopped him, and he thought now that was what I meant to do. And what peace would that bring, I asked. You call me the idiot, and you've been the idiot all along. Do you think I don't know why you made me a vampire? You couldn't live by yourself. You couldn't manage even the simplest things. For years now I've managed everything while you sat about making a pretense of superiority. There's nothing left for you to tell me about life. I have no need of you, and no use for you. It's you who need me. And if you touch but one of the Frenier slaves, I'll get rid of you. It will be a battle between us, and I needn't point out to you I have more wit to fare better in my little finger than you in your entire frame. Do as I say. Well, this startled him, though it shouldn't have, and he protested he had much to tell me of things and types of people I might kill who would cause sudden death, and places in the world I must never go, and so forth and so on. Nonsense that I could hardly endure. But I had no time for him. The overseer's lights were lit at Frenier. He was trying to quell the excitement of the runaway slaves and his own. And the fire of Pont du Lac could be seen still against the sky. Babette was dressed and attending to business, having sent carriages to Pont du Lac and slaves to help fight the blaze.
The frightened runaways were kept away from the others, and at that point no one regarded their stories as any more than slave foolishness. Babette knew something dreadful had happened and suspected murder, never the supernatural. She was in the study making a note of the fire in the plantation diary when I found her. It was almost morning. I had only a few minutes to convince her she must help. I spoke to her at first, refusing to let her turn around, and calmly she listened. I told her I must have a room for the day, to rest. "I've never brought you harm. I ask you now for a key, and your promise that no one will try to enter that room until tonight. Then I'll tell you all." I was nearly desperate now. The sky was paling. Lestat was yards off in the orchard with the coffins. "But why have you come to me tonight?" she asked.
"And why not to you?" I replied. "Did I not help you at the very moment when you most needed guidance, when you alone stood strong among those who are dependent and weak? Did I not twice offer you good counsel? And haven't I watched over your happiness ever since?" I could see the figure of Lestat at the window. He was in a panic. "Give me the key to a room. Let no one come near it till nightfall. I swear to you I would never bring you harm."
"And if I don't? If I believe you come from the devil?" she said now, and meant to turn her head. I reached for the candle and put it out. She saw me standing with my back to the graying windows.
"If you don't, and if you believe me to be the devil, I shall die," I said. "Give me the key. I could kill you now if I chose, do you see?"
And now I moved close to her, and showed myself to her more completely so that she gasped and drew back, holding to the arm of her chair.
"But I would not. I would die rather than kill you. I will die if you don't give me such a key as I ask."
It was accomplished. What she thought, I don't know. But she gave me one of the ground-floor storage rooms where wine was aged, and I'm sure she saw Lestat and me bringing the coffins. I not only locked the door, but barricaded it. Lestat was up the next evening when I awoke. Then she kept her word.
Yes, only she had gone a step further.
She had not only respected our locked door, she had locked it again from without. And the stories of the slaves, she'd heard them.
Yes, she had.
Lestat was the first to discover we were locked in, however.
He became furious. He had planned to get to New Orleans as fast as possible. He was now completely suspicious of me. "I only needed you as long as my father lived," he said, desperately trying to find some opening somewhere. The place was a dungeon. "Now I won't put up with anything from you, I warn you." He didn't even wish to turn his back on me. I sat there, straining to hear voices in the rooms above, wishing that he would shut up, not wishing to confide for a moment my feeling for Babette or my hopes. I was also thinking something else. You asked me about feeling and detachment. One of its aspects, detachment with feeling, I should say, is that you can think of two things at the same time. You can think that you are not safe and may die, and you can think of something very abstract and remote, and this was definitely so with me. I was thinking at that moment, wordlessly and rather deeply, how sublime friendship between Lestat and me might have been, how few impediments to it there would have been, and how much to be shared. Perhaps it was the closeness of Babette which caused me to feel it, for how could I truly ever come to know Babette except, of course, through the one final way, to take her life, to become one with her in an embrace of death, when my soul would become one with her heart and nourished with it. But my soul wanted to know Babette without my need to kill, without robbing her of every breath of life, every drop of blood. But Lestat, how we might have known each other had he been a man of character, a man of even a little thought. The old man's words came back to me. Lestat
a brilliant pupil, a lover of books that had been burned. I knew only the Lestat who sneered at my library, called it a pile of dust, ridiculed relentlessly my reading, my meditations. I became aware now that the house over our heads was quieting. Now and then feet moved, and the boards creaked, and the light in the cracks of the boards gave a faint, uneven illumination. I could see Lestat feeling along the brick walls, his hard, enduring vampire face a twisted mask of human frustration. I was confident we must part ways at once, that I must, if necessary, put an ocean between us. And I realized that I'd tolerated him this long because of self-doubt. I'd fooled myself into believing I stayed for the old man and for my sister and her husband. But I stayed with Lestat because I was afraid he did know essential secrets as a vampire, which I could not discover alone, and, more important, because he was the only one of my kind whom I knew. He had never told me how he had become a vampire, or where I might find a single other member of our kind. This troubled me greatly then, as much as it had for 4 years. I hated him, and wanted to leave him. Yet could I leave him? Meantime, as all this passed through my thoughts, Lestat continued his diatribe. He didn't need me. He wasn't going to put up with anything, especially not any threat from the Freniers. We had to be ready when that door opened. Remember, he said to me finally, speed and strength, they cannot match us in that. And fear. Remember always to strike fear. Don't be sentimental now. You'll cost us everything. You wish to be on your own after this? I asked him. I wanted him to say it. I did not have the courage. Or rather, I did not know my own feelings. I want to get to New Orleans, he said. I was simply warning you I don't need you. But to get out of here, we need each other. You don't begin to know how to use your powers. You have no innate sense of what you are. Use your persuasive powers with this woman if she comes, but if she comes with others, then be prepared to act like what you are. Which is what? I asked him, because it had never seemed such a mystery to me as it did at that time. What am I? He was openly disgusted. He threw up his hands. Be prepared, he said, now baring his magnificent teeth, to kill. He looked suddenly at the boards overhead. They're going to bed up there, do you hear them? After a long silent time, during which Lestat paced and I sat there musing, plumbing my mind for what I might do or say to Babette, or, deeper still, for the answer to a harder question, what did I feel for Babette? After a long time, a light flared beneath the door. Lestat was poised to jump whoever should open it. It was Babette alone, and she entered with a lamp, not seeing Lestat, who stood behind her, but looking directly at me. I had never seen her as she looked then. Her hair was down for bed, a mass of dark waves behind her white dressing gown, and her face was tight with worry and fear. This gave it a feverish radiance, and made her large brown eyes all the more huge. As I have told you, I loved her strength and honesty, the greatness of her soul, and I did not feel passion for her as you would feel it, but I found her more alluring than any woman I'd known in mortal life. Even in the severe dressing gown, her arms and breasts were round and soft, and she seemed to me an intriguing soul, clothed in rich, mysterious flesh. I, who am hard and spare, and dedicated to a purpose, felt drawn to her irresistibly, and, knowing it could only culminate in death, I turned away from her at once, wondering if when she gazed into my eyes, she found them dead and soulless. "You are the one who came to me before," she said now, as if she hadn't been sure. "And you are the owner of Pointe du Lac." "You are!" I knew as she spoke that she must have heard the wildest stories of last night, and there would be no convincing her of any lie. I had used my unnatural appearance twice to reach her, to speak to her. I could not hide it or minimize it now. "I mean you no harm," I said to her. "I need only a carriage and horses. The horses I left last night in the pasture." She didn't seem to hear my words. She drew closer, determined to catch me in the circle of her light. And then I saw Lestat behind her, his shadow merging with her shadow on the brick wall. He was anxious and dangerous. "You will give me the carriage?" I insisted. She was looking at me now, the lamp raised, and just when I meant to look away, I saw her face change. It went still, blank, as if her soul were losing its consciousness. She closed her eyes and shook her head. It occurred to me that I had somehow caused her to go into a trance without any effort on my part. "What are you?" she whispered. "You're from the devil? You were from the devil when you came to me?" "The devil," I answered her. This distressed me more than I thought I could be distressed. If she believed this, then she would think my counsel bad. She would question herself. Her life was rich and good, and I knew she mustn't do this. Like all strong people, she suffered always a measure of loneliness. She was a marginal outsider, a secret infidel of a certain sort. And the balance by which she lived might be upset if she were to question her own goodness. She stared at me with undisguised horror. It was as if, in horror, she forgot her own vulnerable position. And now Lestat, who was drawn to weakness like a parched man to water, grabbed her wrist and she screamed and dropped the lamp. The flames leapt in the splattered oil and Lestat pulled her backwards towards the open door. "You get the carriage," he said to her. "Get it now, and the horses. You are in mortal danger. Don't talk of devils." I stomped on the flames and went for Lestat, shouting at him to leave her. He had her by both wrists, and she was furious. "You'll rouse the house if you don't shut up," he said to me, "and I'll kill her. Get the carriage. Lead us. Talk to the stable boy," he said to her, pushing her into the open air. We moved slowly across the dark court, my distress almost unbearable, Lestat ahead of me, and before us both Babette, who moved backwards, her eyes peering at us in the dark. Suddenly she stopped. One dim light burned in the house above. "I'll get you nothing," she said. I reached for Lestat's arm and told him I must handle this. "She'll reveal us to everyone unless you let me talk to her," I whispered to him. "Then get yourself in check," he said disgustedly. "Be strong. Don't quibble with her." "You go as I talk. Go to the stables and get the carriage and the horses. But don't kill." Whether he'd obey me or not, I didn't know. But he darted away just as I stepped up to Babette. Her face was a mixture of fury and resolution. She said, "Get thee behind me, Satan," and I stood there. Before her, then, speechless, just holding her in my glance as surely as she held me. If she could hear Lestat in the night, she gave no indication. Her hatred for me burned like fire. "Why do you say this to me?" I asked. "Was the counsel I gave you bad? Did I do you harm? I came to help you, to give you strength. I thought only of you when I had no need to think of you at all." She shook her head. "But why? Why do you talk to me like this?" she asked. "I know what you've done to Pointe du Lac. You've lived there like a devil. The slaves are wild with stories. All day men have been on the river road on the way to Pointe du Lac. My husband was there. He saw the house in ruins, the bodies of slaves throughout the orchards, the fields. What are you? Why do you speak to me gently? What do you want of me?" She clung now to the pillars of the porch and was backing slowly to the staircase. Something moved above,
in the lighted window. "I cannot give you such answers now," I said to her. "Believe me when I tell you I came to you only to do you good, and would not have brought worry and care to you last night for anything, had I the choice."
The vampire stopped. The boy sat forward, his eyes wide. The vampire was frozen, staring off, lost in his thoughts, his memory. And the boy looked down, suddenly, as if this were the respectful thing to do. He glanced again at the vampire and then away, his own face as distressed as the vampire's, and then he started to say something, but he stopped. The vampire turned towards him and studied him, so that the boy flushed and looked away again anxiously. But then he raised his eyes and looked into the vampire's eyes. He swallowed, but he held the vampire's gaze.
"Is this what you want?" the vampire whispered. "Is this what you wanted to hear?"
He moved the chair back soundlessly and walked to the window. The boy sat as if stunned, looking at his broad shoulders and the long mass of the cape. The vampire turned his head slightly.
"You don't answer me. I'm not giving you what you want, am I? You wanted an interview. Something to broadcast on the radio."
"That doesn't matter. I'll throw the tapes away if you want." The boy rose. "I can't say I understand all you're telling me. You'd know I was lying if I said I did. So how can I ask you to go on, except to say what I do understand? What I do understand is like nothing I've ever understood before." He took a step towards the vampire. The vampire appeared to be looking down into Divisadero Street. Then he turned his head slowly and looked at the boy and smiled. His face was serene and almost affectionate, and the boy suddenly felt uncomfortable. He shoved his hands into his pockets and turned towards the table. Then he looked at the vampire tentatively and said, "Will you please go on?" The vampire turned with folded arms and leaned against the window.
"Why?" he asked.
The boy was at a loss.
"Because I want to hear it," he shrugged. "Because I want to know what happened." "All right," said the vampire, with the same smile playing on his lips.
And he went back to the chair and sat opposite the boy, and turned the recorder just a little, and said,
"Marvelous contraption, really. So let me go on. You must understand that what I felt for Babette now was a desire for communication, stronger than any other desire I then felt, except for the physical desire for blood. It was so strong in me, this desire, that it made me feel the depth of my capacity for loneliness. When I'd spoken to her before, there had been a brief but direct communication which was as simple and as satisfying as taking a person's hand, clasping it, letting it go gently. All this in a moment of great need and distress. But now we were at odds. To Babette I was a monster, and I found it horrible to myself and would have done anything to overcome her feeling. I told her the counsel I'd given her was right, that no instrument of the devil could do right even if he chose.
I know,
she answered me, but by this she meant that she could no more trust me than the devil himself. I approached her, and she moved back. I raised my hand, and she shrank, clutching for the railing. All right, then, I said, feeling a terrible exasperation. Why did you protect me last night? Why have you come to me alone? What I saw in her face was cunning. She had a reason, but she would by no means reveal it to me. It was impossible for her to speak to me freely, openly, to give me the communication I desired. I felt weary looking at her. The night was already late, and I could see and hear that Lestat had stolen into the wine cellar and taken our caskets, and I had a need to get away. And other needs besides, the need to kill and drink. But it wasn't that which made me weary.
It was something else, something far worse. It was as if this night were only one of thousands of nights, world without end, night curving into night to make a great arching line of which I couldn't see the end, a night in which I roamed alone under cold, mindless stars. I think I turned away from her and put my hand to my eyes. I felt oppressed and weak suddenly. I think I was making some sound without my will. And then on this vast and desolate landscape of night, where I was standing alone and where Babette was only an illusion, I saw suddenly a possibility that I'd never considered before, a possibility from which I'd fled, wrapped as I was with a world, fallen into the senses of the vampire, in love with color and shape and sound and singing and softness and infinite variation. Babette was moving, but I took no note of it. She was taking something from her pocket. Her great ring of household keys jingled there. She was moving up the steps. "Let her go away," I was thinking. "Creature of the devil," I whispered. "Get thee behind me, Satan," I repeated. I turned to look at her now. She was frozen on the steps with wide, suspicious eyes. She'd reached the lantern which hung on the wall, and she held it in her hands, just staring at me, holding it tight, like a valuable purse. "You think I come from the devil?" I asked her. She quickly moved her left fingers around the hook of the lantern and with her right hand made the sign of the cross, the Latin words barely audible to me, and her face blanched and her eyebrows rose when there was absolutely no change because of it. "Did you expect me to go up in a puff of smoke?" I asked her. I drew closer now, for I had gained detachment from her by virtue of my thoughts. "And where would I go?" I asked her. "And where would I go? To hell, from whence I came? To the devil from whom I came?" I stood at the foot of the steps. "Suppose I told you I know nothing of the devil. Suppose I told you that I do not even know if he exists." It was the devil I'd seen upon the landscape of my thoughts. It was the devil about whom I thought now. I turned away from her. She wasn't hearing me as you are now. She wasn't listening. I looked up at the stars. Lestat was ready, I knew it. It was as if he'd been ready there with the carriage for years, and she had stood upon the step for years. I had the sudden sensation my brother was there and had been there for ages also, and that he was talking to me low in an excited voice, and what he was saying was desperately important, but it was going away from me as fast as he said it, like the rustle of rats in the rafters of an immense house. There was a scraping sound and a burst of light. "I don't know whether I come from the devil or not. I don't know what I am," I shouted at Babette, my voice deafening in my own sensitive ears. "I am to live to the end of the world, and I do not even know what I am." But the light flared before me. It was the lantern which she had lit with a match and held now so I couldn't see her face. For a moment I could see nothing but the light. And then the great weight of the lantern struck me full force in the chest, and the glass shattered on the bricks, and the flames roared on my legs, in my face. Lestat was shouting from the darkness, put it out, idiot, it will consume you!" And I felt something thrashing me wildly in my blindness. It was Lestat's jacket. I'd fallen helpless back against the pillar, helpless as much from the fire and the blow as from the knowledge that Babette meant to destroy me, as from the knowledge that I did not know what I was. All this happened in a matter of seconds. The fire was out, and I knelt in the dark with my hands on the bricks. Lestat at the top of the stairs had Babette again, and I flew up after him, grabbing him about the neck and pulling him backwards. He turned on me, enraged, and kicked me. But I clung to him and pulled him down on top of me to the bottom. Babette was petrified. I saw her dark outline against the sky and the glint of light in her eyes. "Come on, then," Lestat said, scrambling to his feet. Babette was putting her hand to her throat. My injured eyes strained to gather the light to see her. Her throat bled. "Remember," I said to her, "I might have killed you.
or let him kill you. I did not. You called me devil.
You are wrong.
Then you'd stopped Lestat just in time, said the boy.